This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for choosing the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. Perhaps because we're surrounded by them more or less all the time and they're pretty easy to see, both Ewan and I, Ewan McElraith, my colleague, are absolutely fascinated by birds.
One of the positive things of lockdown is it's given us time to look at birds in depth, the mythology, the folklore, the natural history.
There is one particular species that we're going to concentrate on in this podcast, and it's got a story that begins and ends in Scotland. Roger Morgan Grenville is author of a new book called Shearwater, which tracks the journey of one of nature's great travellers, the Manx Shearwater. Roger, thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. It's lovely to be with you.
You became fascinated by Manx Shearwaters when you were a child, but it was basically on the island of Mull in the Inner Hebrides.
Yeah, my grandmother moved up there. She lost her husband early and moved up and just bought a croft down at the bottom of the Ross of Mull. And we spent our summers there. And what she did and what was so brilliant for me was she introduced you sort of face on to wildlife. She didn't romanticise it. She just said, right, we're going to get in a boat and we're going to go and watch seabirds. She used to take us out once a year with the local boatman, who I remember just being very miserable. And we'd sort of land on Stafford if it wasn't rough, but otherwise we'd just go and watch the puffins. If you're a youngster, a puffin's a wonderful thing to see. But I was a stroppy 12-year-old, and so if they were looking for puffins, I wanted to look for something else. And I saw this bird flying past, and I couldn't clock it. I couldn't work out what it was. And eventually I had to ask Callum, and I said, what is it? What does it do? And he said, ah, that's a Manx shearwater. And then it kind of all came from there. And you know, as a kid, you get these things and then you never lose them. And that's what happened.
Just read it to me, that bit about actually seeing the first Manxie.
40 minutes later, we were nearing the dark and vertical mass of Staffa, its symmetrical bulk softening into its true natural irregularity as we approached. There were puffins, guillemots and razorbills bobbing around in the sea on the right side of the boat, which everyone else was watching from the starboard rail. I stayed on the other side watching gannets, and possibly just to make an adolescent point about not following the crowd or being predictable. Also, I knew that I would see things that the others wouldn't, which was the important thing, my lists being as much about competition as they were the true records of sightings. That was the precise moment I saw it for the first time. I could still hear my grandmother's voice in the background, telling Callum about something bad that had happened in Morocco earlier that week, a coup or something. And Callum, whose horizons in his latter years stretched genuinely no further than the sea around the Ross of Mull, saying enigmatically, "Aye, well, that'll be the way folk do things down there." At first, I thought it might be a gull or a fulmar as it raced towards me, but no, it was flying through the air in the wrong way and far too fast. It seemed to be more in the sea than above it. Three quick wing beats glide, jinking this way and that, and always with one wingtip seeming to touch the waves. As it drew closer, I saw the torpedo-shaped body, the thin sickle wings, the white underside, and the dark top. When it passed directly behind the boat and the end feathers of its right wing appeared to brush the very wave itself, and I knew for certain I'd never seen this bird before. I knew nothing of it, save that for a fleeting second it had shone a beam of light into a world of wildness for me. I followed it round the stern of the boat, suddenly panicking that I'd lose sight of it before I knew what it was and miss the opportunity of a rarity. "Callum," I shouted, politeness thrown to the wind, "what's that?" "That's a shearwater," he said slowly, once he'd turned around and watched it for a second or two. And then after a pause, She'll be a Manx shearwater. Puffinus, puffinus. He might not have known about coos in Morocco, but he knew the Latin name of every bird around the shores of his islands. She's a big wanderer, you know, one of the biggest of them all. Over the years, I came to realise that all Callum's birds were she. I came back to sit next to him by the tiller. What do they... I couldn't think of the right word, so I just picked the first one that came into my head. What do they do? While he spoke, there were more shearwaters passing the back of his boat, heading back to some new fishery with a sense of purpose that seemed to elude the other seabirds. What do they do? He repeated, pausing to see the effect of his words. I suppose they just fly and fly till there's no more ocean to fly over. These ones here will only be around a few weeks, and then, next stop, the South Atlantic.
You mentioned the name, or the Latin name, Linnaean name, Puffinus puffinus. Correct me if I'm wrong, they're not actually related in any way, shape or form to puffins.
No, they're not. Shearwaters are part of the petrel family, which includes albatrosses, petrels, storm petrels. And as you know, you can tell them all by the tube nostrils they have on their top of their noses. Basically, the puffin nicked the shearwater's name because the puffin used to be called the sea parrot. But I think that shearwater as a descriptor of what it actually does is brilliant. You know, it's a lovely name.
You described that encounter beautifully. I can see it in my mind's eye. But there was a big, big gap. I mean, decades between you seeing that and really this bird coming back into your life. Tell us about that.
I was always interested in birds when I was out by the coast and up in Mull, but oftentimes just looking at other stuff. And then I went as a soldier down to South Georgia in the South Atlantic, and I met albatrosses when I was about 24, 25. And that rekindled it. And I was always then wanting to get out and find an excuse to be at the sea. But it was always on the seaside rather than out at sea. And then a couple of years ago, I was up with my wife up on staying on Muck, and a friend took us out in a boat. And I guess it was seeing the shearwater coming from exactly the same angle as the one in Mull had come from all those years before. And it suddenly just blew my mind. And 2 days later, I'd been sort of 6 months researching a book on insects. And I just said to my wife on the ferry back to Malaig, I can't do this. I need to write a book about shearwater. So that's where it came.
Did you actually climb up on Rum?
Yeah, I did. I went up to the top of Halival a couple of times. And subsequently in the book, I went up, you know, a few more times. And there's that kind of wonderful thing where if you don't know your birds, you think there's rabbit holes. But anyone who knows Rum knows there are no rabbits. And actually what you've got are these high altitude burrows for the shearwaters. And you know, you sit there at night and the noise just goes bonkers. So this is on top of Halival, and this is probably 1 o'clock in the morning with the guys from the Oxford University team. Tim stopped talking. There was an urgent fluttering and whirring sound in the dark, like a bird flying around a room it's got stuck in. And then a light thump behind me announced the overture. I turned round, struggling to keep my balance on the steep bank, and in the limited red glow of my head torch, caught sight of a dark grey and white shape shuffling rapidly uphill towards the mouth of a marked burrow. Then the noises started. It begins with one calling bird flying out of the night towards its burrow, like a soloist in a discordant concerto. There's a tiny rushing of wind, a bump in the vicinity, and then silence. Then one bird becomes two, two becomes five, five becomes 30, and 30 becomes 500, as each section of the orchestra gets going at its own particular tempo, and the whole island seems to be given over to noise. Part owl, part gull, part parrot and part howling baby. The night becomes full of fast-moving sounds, adult calling to chick, chick responding to adult, all invisible save for a second or two, ranging from a deep chuckling to the screeching hinges of a gate into bedlam. The noises pass in front of you, behind you and above your head. Added to this are the bumps of the birds landing close by, and the whooshing as they fly by within feet, sometimes within inches of your face in the darkness. At times, they actually make contact with your body. Both chilling and comical, the noise continually ratchets up in volume and intensity until at about 2 o'clock in the morning, everything around is unthinkably loud, as if a little bit of chaos has come to make its home here. Small wonder, I thought, that these were known as the devil birds, for the unearthly nighttime calls they brought with them, or that the Vikings in the boats below once believed the place to be full of trolls and sailed away.
I was up there probably about 10, 15 years ago, but I confess it's taken me right back.
I'm just starting to hear them. We're starting to more or less feel their passing. And here, literally 3 feet away from me, is a Manx shearwater. Sooty grey bird with a sort of slightly, rather elegantly built beak, very small black beady eye, and the white underbelly. These long, almost swallow-shaped wings. I'll tell you something else I've heard. I mean, the cry goes da-da-da, da-da-da. And every so often you get one that goes da-da-da, you know, thud.
Yes, it's. I think the translation of that would be sort of something of an expletive.
I saw one go past there, just the shadow of one. I said, just so weird, sitting up on top of a mountain in pitch darkness, with these sounds all around you.
Ooh, that was close.
Sent a parting time.
One of the things I was quite surprised by, well, normally evolution equips you to deal with the hand you've got, but evolution hasn't actually equipped the Manx shearwater to be any better than a diurnal bird flying around at night. And so they do hit things. And if you go and talk to the researchers in Skomer, they get hit all the time. And indeed, when I was down there, I got whacked in the side of the head by one. And I kind of wore it like a badge of honour. You know, you can't leave these places until you've been whacked by at least one.
The Manx shearwater, describe it for us and talk about that incredible migration.
If I was describing it to someone who didn't see a picture, it's like a sort of a streamlined seagull. The reason I wrote the book was this idea that when it's about 60 days old, its parents abandon it in the burrow. And then by this point, it's about 50% bigger than them. It loses 30% of its body weight. And when it's ready to go, it just comes out to the top of the burrow one night, flaps its wings, and it goes. And it will not touch land again for 4 years because it won't come back and touch land till it's ready to breed. And something within it, its instinct, leads it 8,000 miles down the coast of Europe, down the west coast of Africa, across the shortest bit of the Atlantic, down the Brazilian coast, to out between the Falklands and Argentina, its summer fishing grounds. And it does that at the equivalent age of a baby human being 6 months. And it makes it all the way down there. And by the time it gets down, it just joins the other shearwaters and starts fishing. We as humans think of land as safe and sea as dangerous. So we see the cliffs as the edge lands of what is safe. And we look out to sea and we just see danger and stuff, wilderness and stuff we can't control. It's exactly opposite for a pelagic bird, one that spends its life out at sea. It sees the land as something it will only go to when it absolutely has to. And it hasn't yet developed a way of breeding at sea. So they come in to what is incredibly dangerous. You know, out at sea, there's almost nothing that will get them. But in land, there's a menu of about 25 things that will get them if they can.
And what made you decide to try and follow the migration route? To use an old Scots expression, that's a hell of a tack on.
I'll tell you exactly what it was. I'd been down in Skomer, which is, you know, their main breeding island off Wales. And I'd watched them go. I'd watched the last of them leave. And I was driving back home really quite sad about it. And thought, well, I'll pick it up again in March when they come back. And then I just got home and I noticed that British Airways had a sale on and flights to Argentina were about 350 quid. So I just bought one. And a month and a half later, I found myself on an aeroplane going down to Argentina and following them.
I mean, you know, you see the equivalent of a six-month-old baby, you know, human baby, stepping out of the house and just disappearing, an 8,000-mile trip. How do they know where to go? Do they follow the adult spot?
Well, basically, on the way down, it is thought that it is just imprinted, its instinct within them. And on the way up, it's as they're sort of heading for home in as much as the burrow is home. it is a combination of smell, stars, magnetism. And then when they get closer to the Irish coast site, you know, these birds can live for up to 50 years. So they'll start picking up rocks that they remember and things. Also, there are wide ranges when they go out to fish. So a bird that's nesting on rum may well fly 1,200 miles out into the mid-Atlantic to fish. So they kind of know the seas. The thing that really I found amazing was this idea that when the chick comes out, before it flies off, for about 4 or 5 nights, it sits at the top of its burrow in the moonlight and just does nothing. And no one could work out what it was. Well, what they're actually doing is a thing called astral imprinting, where they are literally imprinting in their mind a map of the heavens that they then use 4 years later to come back, not just to that island, but that 1 meter square with the hole in it.
But it goes wrong sometimes with it, doesn't it, Roger? I've been up in Mallig when the Manx shearwaters come out of the burrows and they just see the bright lights of Mallig. And the town is littered with them. Cars stop and people are looking in garages, under vehicles, incredible things, just to get these birds back into a place where they can relocate themselves in the stars.
Mallig's the only town I know of in the UK where this happens regularly. And I think because their breeding sites on rum are on the east side, where they'll be seeing Mallig, they mistake the light for a gleam of the moon on the sea. That's what they think. And it's really only bad when it's heavily windy and stormy. And I think 1 year they had about 1,200, and the cats and the gulls get some of them. But often enough, they get rescued and put in shoeboxes and taken out on the Calmac ferry and relaunched. I love that. You know, what a great use of a ferry.
Coming back to the sense of smell, you mentioned the tube noses, Procelliforms, the order of the storm birds. It's not just a case of a navigation aid. They find food through a sense of smell.
That they do. And again, it's a great bit of science that discovered it. But basically, where things are feeding on krill, the disturbed krill near the surface release a gas called dimethyl sulfide, DMS. And so what a bird is doing, flying downwind until it picks up a trace of this. And then if it picks up a trace, it goes, well, there's obviously food there. And it then quarters, it triangulates back up until it finds it. Because I always wondered, if you're flying at 35 miles an hour, 8 foot above the sea, you ain't going to see a fish. But they don't need to. They never fly upwind. They always fly downwind or along it until they've, you know, once they're ready, then they'll tack into the wind to find the smell. And then they'll feed. And they're lucky birds because, unlike a puffin, which just eats sand eels, the Alb shearwater eats just about anything. And therefore, it's not nearly as reliant on one food source. And that's a big problem for a lot of seabirds. One of the things that amazes me about the shearwater is it's got 3 states of sleep: wide awake, in the air, fast asleep on the sea, and then half asleep where it shuts down half its body in one eye and goes a little bit higher. And I always thought, well, if it was half asleep and it picked up one of these smells, that must be a lovely way to wake up. Oh, breakfast. Swing off to the left.
You mentioned Skomer Island earlier. Tell me about Ronald Lockley.
Well, Ronald Lockley, he was actually on the island immediately south, Skokholm. And this was in the late 20s and 30s and 40s. And in a way, he's kind of one of the fathers of modern British ornithology. He just wrote a 12-year book about the shearwater. And one of the things he was fascinated with was where they go and how they get there. And obviously, he had observation. He was very good at that. But he didn't have any of the geolocators or GPS or anything else. So when they went out of sight, that was it. And if you were one of his friends and you came to visit him, he'd give you a wickerwork basket when you headed off and said, right, I've got 3 shearwaters in here. You're going back to Dartmouth or you're going back to Frensham Ponds. Relaunch them. And so people did. And he'd then see they came back. But it wasn't until 1953 when he sent a load of birds back with an academic friend to Cambridge. And they were launched off the top of the Cambridge Library. And there were about 4 of them were back in their burrows that night. That was the moment that they realised these birds can orientate themselves and they know the sense of direction. These birds can navigate. And that was almost the first time in the world that people had worked out that's what these birds can do. Because they had to fly over land. They couldn't just follow a coastline round, not the speed they went. And then one of the other things he did was he sent the leader of an orchestra who was going to Boston and said, will you take one of these with you? And the guy was told to let it off outside Boston Airport, which he did. And it was back in its burrow before the letter arrived notifying Lockley of its safe departure.
That moves on in your story to T-72. What is T-72 and why is it special? And how big a part did it play in your life?
T-72 was one of the study birds on the Skomer colony. And the study birds, as far as I'm concerned, pick up the number from their nest. And so they get ringed and you know where they who they are and where they come from. I got an attachment with T-72 because I ringed it. And then about two nights later, I was there at about 2 a.m, just walking past the burrow back from something else we'd been doing, when I saw T-72 doing this astral imprinting, but then starting to shuffle up the path. And I thought, oh, you're about to leave. And so I just sat there for 10 minutes and watched, went up onto a small dry stone wall and off she flew. I was very emotional, actually. I sort of felt an attachment to this bird. She became that kind of will-o'-the-wisp that I could say to myself, I'm following her. As far as I know, she's still out there and she's doing her kind of university education, learning the fishing grounds. And maybe next year, the year after, she'll be back on Skomer and she will raise a bloodline of her own.
The development of things like geolocators and GPS systems has really revolutionised our understanding of these big migrations.
It has. You have to think that all the knowledge they had up until kind of 1910, when they first kind of ringed a bird for research reasons, was what they saw in the breeding sites and everything else. And there's a wonderful book in one of the Oxford libraries, 800-page book of observations of seabirds from lighthouses. And what that actually basically means is birds that whacked into lighthouses at 2 o'clock in the morning. So all the way off Ireland, all these lighthouse keepers were sending back these records of these birds having hit them. But I think what the GPS has allowed now is real-time tracking of the journeys these birds make. And so that, you know, they were able to discover that an albatross goes up to 15,000 kilometres for a meal. And the old shearwater goes, the ones that are feeding the chicks go out quite close, but the ones that are feeding themselves will go out 1,500 miles. And they can produce these wonderful charts of where they go. And so one of the reasons I knew I was going to be okay in Argentina down at Valdez was I had all the information from the previous years. And although all the Argentine bird watchers were telling me, no, they don't come here, I was going, well, actually, they do, because I'm looking at these charts. And sure enough, they did.
What about the state of the birds? How are they doing? There was a bit that was a real eye-opener to me. I didn't know this. That they were caught as bait for lobster pots. They were used as organic manure. They've had a hard time. How are they doing now? Because so many birds are under threat.
Well, the background to this is that seabirds in general are doing terribly. And there's a statistic that since Queen Elizabeth has been on the throne, worldwide 1.5 billion seabirds has become 500 million. So 66% decline. Shearwaters are doing quite well, and you know, relatively well. They've stabilised, and there is evidence that they're going up, which kind of in conservation these days is well. And there's a number of reasons for that. One is that they're quite cute. They nest on islands where people happen not to be, and they've benefited heavily from the rat extermination projects on places like Canna, Lundy, and a couple of the Scilly Isles. One of the big problems for the bigger birds is bycatch off trawlers and going down onto a baited line and then being pulled down with it. But shearwaters, fortunately, aren't great boat followers. And when they fish, it's kind of at about 7 or 8 metres normally, which is below the danger area of the trawler and above the net. And then the last one is with turbines, sea turbines. That's causing quite a few bird deaths now. But the shearwater flies too low to get involved.
I'm personally interested in this because we're the same age. It's not a midlife crisis unless the pair of us decide to live to 120. You suddenly take it into your head, right, I'm going to buy a ticket to Argentina, I'm going to go where they go, I'm going to see what they... You went all the way down to Patagonia. That's not a 5-minute bus trip. What did you see while you were there in terms of Manx shearwaters?
Not a lot. I saw on the second last day I was there, I'd reached an accommodation with myself that I would see sooties or corys, but I wouldn't actually find them. But on the last day, I went out in this whale-watching boat, not because I wanted to watch whales, particularly, but I just wanted to get as far out to sea as I could again. I remember everyone was photographing this whale off the right side of the boat, and I was looking off the left side, and there was a Magellanic penguin going past, and the guide said, "Ah, you're interested in penguins." And I just saw these two Manxes about 200 metres beyond, and I nearly cried. You know, I'd spent two or three weeks and hundreds of pounds getting myself there. But the great thing about a Manxie, when you're identifying them, is that they're a lot smaller than the two big shearwaters who are also down there, but they're bigger than the little shearwaters. So when you see them, you know them. I remember sitting in the plane on the way back, 14-hour flight back in the rows by the toilets, and sending a thing up to the captain saying, "I'm doing a thing about bird navigation. Do you fancy a chat?" And to my absolute astonishment, she walked down at sort of 2 o'clock in the morning. And so we've always wanted as someone who knows about bird navigation, but we can't ask you onto the cockpit. And so we sort of chatted about how she flew back and how my shearwaters flew back.
But you got a bit, when you're out of an evening, in amongst the flock, just on the water, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Talk me through that, because it sounds like a magical experience.
It's a magical experience, and it's something that your listeners can really go and experience, because basically a shearwater, an adult shearwater, doesn't go up to the burrow until it's pitch dark, but they'll finish fishing in the daylight. And so from about 5 o'clock on a summer's evening onwards, they start gathering in what are known as rafts. And I think the biggest one they've measured off Rum is up about 30,000 birds. So I persuaded this guy to take me out there. And it's in the narrow bit between Egg and Rum. So, you know, it's not a mystery of how to find it. And then they come and they come and they come. And it's just this incredible contrast between these 10,000, we think we were around 10,000, placid shearwaters sitting on the thing on a sunny evening with minke whales breaching through them. And then you knew that about 5-6 hours later, they were going to be up shouting their heads off 2,000 foot up the mountain, where my friends from Oxford were.
I actually highlighted this. Stripped of all the attendant science and complexity that I'd thrown its way in the last year, the shearwater remained a simple metaphor for the act of going beyond the horizon.
There is a certain point where you've gone beyond David Attenborough. You actually need to go and throw yourself out there. And this was something that my granny and Mull gave me, absolutely. Everything is street lit, and then there's a shadow, and you need to go there. It's that thing of wildernesses. Alder Leopold or someone said, if we didn't have wildernesses, we'd have to invent them. And what I think is concerning is that we are finding ways of losing wildernesses too quickly. And that's not just important from the biodiversity point of view, but from the human experience point of view. And, you know, not everyone can afford to go up to the Arctic and enjoy it. But most people can get out, particularly in Scotland, get out to a moor or a side of a bend, or, you know, over to Rum, and it's there, and you're in a different world, and it's not your world, it's their world. And that's what I love.
Roger, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Oh, it's been a huge pleasure. I mean, I really enjoyed it, and thank you very much.
And we enjoyed it too. Roger's book, Shearwater, is published by Icon Books. Get in touch with us, if you like, and tell us where you listen to this podcast. We do like hearing from you. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. For myself, Mark Stephen, Ewan McElraith, producer Helen Needham, and Roger Morgan Grenville, thank you very much for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.